Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. And we have a very special program for you today. We're going to continue with a call-in program. That is, call in with your questions and your comments. This is a continuation of a show we did back in January, Barack Obama, the Democratic Party, and the Corporate State, False Hope and Short Change. This will be part two. Today, Tuesday, March 4th, very special day for the Democratic Party. In Ohio and Texas, Rhode Island and Vermont, there are primaries with a total of 370 pledged delegates at stake. This is the second biggest delegate day of the year for the Democratic Party, with the presidential candidacy at risk. In Texas, according to the Washington Post, participation in early voting is 10 times higher than it was 4 years ago in a number of the state's biggest counties. And in Ohio, the Secretary of State has predicted that just over half the electorate may vote. Now, let's look at what's going on in Ohio, because there the TV screens have been replete with ads, and two of the biggest unions, the Service Employees International Union and the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, have spent their money on major buys supporting Barack Obama. Imagine Barack Obama. This is what the unions are doing with their money. In the last presidential election, the AFL-CIO spent itself more than $40 million on the election. And then if you add up the different individual unions, as we see here with the Service Employees International Union and the United Food and Commercial Workers Union having their own major buys, we see it's big bucks on the part of the unions, taking workers' money and misdirecting it to these false leaders. In Ohio, Clinton had a small single-digit lead in the public polls. In a campaign which is discussing economic issues because of the high unemployment and particularly the impact of NAFTA on Ohio. Texas, however, is a state that doesn't have just a traditional primary, which will take place today. But once the polls close, there are caucuses that will be held at 8,000 sites, creating what for the Democratic pundits is a confused election. How do they address Texas? What do they do? They can't do what they did in California, where the Clinton campaign waged an offensive with millions and millions upon millions of telephone calls to the electorate. Ralph?
Well, Maya, what we're dealing with here is the same old, and it's important, I think, to emphasize that the Barack Obama National Security Advisor people and all the people who basically run this person, who, like all these politicians, is essentially a front man. These are public relations types. Whatever the rhetoric and whatever the various political posturings, they don't run the show. They carry out the orders. Here is a short list of who we're talking about here. Former Ambassador Jeffrey Bader, President Clinton's National Security Advisor, Asia Specialist, and head of the Brookings Institute's China Center, is a National Security Advisor to Obama. Mark Brzezinski, Clinton's National Security Council Southeast Asia Specialist, likewise. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's National Security Advisor, Center for Strategic and International Studies trustee, the architect of the Grand Chessboard and the entire creation of the, quote, Al-Qaeda, unquote, in Afghanistan, ditto. Except that because of the fact that Carter and Brzezinski want a Bantustan in the West Bank, their formulation is that to avoid an apartheid Israel, there should be a NATO occupation of the West Bank with a Palestinian police and military under their control, and that the excitable Muslims have to be dealt with. That's too far to the left, quote unquote. This is too much of a acknowledgement of even the formal Bantustanization autonomy for the Palestinians, such that Obama has recently said he doesn't support Brzezinski's call for Palestinian rights of that nature. You get the picture. Richard Clark, Clinton and George W. Bush's counterterrorism czar. principal Obama advisor, Gregory Craig, State Department Director of Policy Planning under Clinton. Once again, key figure for Obama. Roger Cracy, National Security Counterterrorism Staffer, Obama. Ivo Dalda, National Security Director for European Affairs under Clinton, Brookings Senior Fellow, Obama. Richard Danzig, President Clinton's Naval Secretary, Center for Strategic and International Analysis, Barack Obama. Philip Gordon, President Clinton's National Security Staffer, Senior Fellow, National Security Staffer for the Brookings Institute, Obama. Major General Jonathan Scott Gratian, the National Security Advisor and Surrogate for Africa, ditto. Lawrence Cobb, Assistant Secretary of Defense, Center for American Progress, again, Barack Obama. Anthony Lake, Clinton's National Security Advisor, key foreign policy determinant for the Clinton administration, Barack Obama.
And also, Anthony Lake was instrumental in the U.S. invasion, you might say, of Haiti in the mid-Clinton years.
So as Alan Nairns very eloquently set forth, what they did with the implementation of the operation in Haiti was basically to put Aristide before the obligation to implement the IMF policies, the most austere measures, the greatest austerity measures ever inflicted on a country, and particularly in the Caribbean, which Aristide implemented at the direction of U.S. imperialism. Lane was the point man for that.
In a country that was already the poorest country in the Americas. The number to call is 212-209-2900. Remember, we are discussing the election campaigns, particularly Barack Obama, the Democratic Party, the corporate state, false hope, and short change. We're interested in your questions and your comments. I'd also like to take a moment to thank all of you who contributed to WBAI and during Taking Aim, and we'll be receiving the premium on the question of is martial law on the agenda, a complete documentation, and we know you'll appreciate it, you'll love to share it, and again, I'd like to send a heartfelt thanks and appreciation to all of you who continue to support listener-sponsored free speech radio, WBAI, a beacon of radio throughout the United States and now throughout the world through the Internet site. Ralph?
Well, Maya, I wanted to also just mention that the figures who are around Barack Obama are not just the architects of U.S. imperialism, but they are the architects of specific genocidal operations like that of General Merrill McPeak, who was involved in overseeing the delivery to Indonesia of U.S. fighter planes for use in East Timor, notably in relation to the Dili massacre. This is just a beginning, a sampling. I mean, the figure who Austin Goolsbee is the economic key figure for Barack Obama, who was in supporting the mortgage foreclosure operations flowing from the subprime crisis and opposed to any freeze on home mortgage foreclosures. In fact, this particular figure who is very closely linked to the administrations of both Bush Sr. and Bush Jr., at the same time an advisor to John Kerry, was a central person in implementing the policies that have caused the crisis for untold millions of people who are facing the loss of their homes today. So we have to understand what this ruling class does with these various political debates. When the population is alienated, when people are angered, when there's a groundswell for change, by change they mean a change in their economic circumstances and a change in the perpetual dependence on war and military outlay in the United States, they trot out a populist rhetoric to channel it, to canalize it, to co-opt it, to defuse it, and they soft soap us during the election time and they sell us out 30 seconds afterwards.
And Ralph, in the case of Barack Obama, who came on strong with the concept of change in the air, and that he was going to be the one who brought change people of the United States, he got a message. He got the message from the Wall Street Journal, hey, you are setting up expectations that we cannot deliver, and yet, very important article in the Wall Street Journal today, not about the campaign, but about the economy. Front page, New York Times. Good news or not, companies in the U.S. are saving piles of cash. Never as before. These corporations are flush with cash in the billions of dollars when it comes to, in the tens of billions of dollars when it comes to a company like Microsoft or IBM, which is buying back its own stock. And compared to 10 and 20 years ago, these corporations are flush. The Standard & Poor's said that the total cash held by companies in its industrial index exceeded $600 billion in February, up from $203 billion in 1998. You know what this cash is? In traditional Marxist terms, it is the surplus value. It is the difference between what is created by the working class in this country and what is returned to the working class in this country. These companies are holding on to their cash. They are not investing in any productive infrastructure. They are cash rich at the same time that people throughout the United States, working people, are suffering. And the same time that people throughout the United States, working people, are losing their homes, are unable to provide health care, are finding it difficult to send their children to school for higher education. At the same time that they can't meet their bills, these companies are flush with cash. The utilities companies, for instance, here in California, Pacific Gas and Electric, while it has raised the fees for providing gas and electric to the homes to hundreds of dollars per month, they too are flush with cash. Ralph?
Well, I want to mention one particular facet of the current crisis for U.S. imperialism around which all of the capitalist candidates coalesce, and no one more so than Barack Obama. That has to do with the current and imminent war in both Gaza and Lebanon extending to Syria. You may recall, brothers and sisters, that a leader of the Hezbollah, the political leader of Hezbollah in Lebanon, was assassinated. And the Israeli press has disclosed that CIA officials have documented that the Mossad was behind the Mugniya killing. The Mugniya killing, which was an outright murder of one of the principal leaders of Hezbollah.
It took place in Damascus, Syria.
Was the actual murder in Damascus? Yes, you're right. It was a Damascus car bombing, and Bruce Rydell, the advisor to three U.S. presidents in the Middle East, has documented that Israel had carried out the operation, the Mossad, in complete compliance with the U.S. Immediately following that, the U.S. Navy dispatched missile destroyer USS Cole to Lebanon, right off the Beirut coast. There is a very concrete plan here. It's linked to what they're doing in Gaza. And the first thing that Barack Obama has done is to send a letter to the United Nations urging them in no way to condemn Israel, criticize Israel for the starving out of the Gaza population, for the saturation bombing of the population in Gaza, because according to the letter from Barack Obama, it is the Palestinian rockets and the Palestinian resistance which is the primary issue, and there can be no condemnation of Israel, which is, quote, merely defending itself. This is by way of preparing for the next step, because all the officials of the Zionist state, from the head of the Labor Party, Barak, to the Prime Minister, Olmert, have declared that they are going to finish Gaza. That means they want a major invasion of Gaza. In fact, the Deputy Defense Minister declared that they were going to create what he called a Shoah. Deputy Defense Minister Matan Vilnai stipulated that an even larger Shoah, which is the Hebrew word for the Holocaust, will be unleashed on Gaza, created a firestorm. This is in the Jerusalem Post on March 2nd. And he states, even a greater Shoah will emerge, because we shall use all our strength in every way stated to Army Radio. The response of Obama to this, Israel must remain a Jewish state, and that all steps must be taken by the United States to ensure that there are no refugee returns to the state of Israel, and that Israel's Jewish nature is preserved and protected militarily. This is code language, brothers and sisters, for the preparation of the war on Lebanon and in Gaza. That's what we are looking at here.
Right. Barack Obama has stated explicitly that the Palestinians should get used to the idea of compensation, that they must revise their estimate of what the right of return actually means. I was thinking today, Ralph, as I was reading his statements about the inherent Jewish nature of the state, what if somebody were to say to him that South Carolina had the right to declare itself a white state, that in fact African Americans, people of Asian descent, people of Hispanic descent had a right to live in South Carolina, but it was really a white state. It was created by white population, and they are the ones who only had constitutional rights. What would he say?
He would say whatever was necessary to say as a figure of those who are, in fact, the settler population enlarged and incorporated within finance capital today. You have here, of course, the ruling class utilizing the Israeli state as their instrument. And the evidence about what they do is massive and continuous. These politicians, all of them, are implementers and designers of this operation.
The number to call is 212-209-2900. We'd like to hear from you. Michael, is anyone on the line? Well, let's take our first call.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Oh, I'm so happy I'm the first, huh?
Yes, you are.
Okay, Ralph Shulman and Marshall Shulman, and, you know, I admire you guys so much that sometimes I hate to even disagree with you.
Please, that's how much I admire you guys.
Because the work you're doing is so great. But anyway, let me try to get my two pennies in, okay?
Please.
Yeah, I'm from, my name is V from Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Originally from Liberia, West Africa.
Yes.
However, I have very strong opinions about Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because I do not regard politicians as angels. Because my father was a lawyer. My uncle was a lawyer. And if you think lawyers and politicians are angels, you belong on another planet. Now, Barack Obama has to make any promises he can make in order to be elected. You know, George Bush promised us the moon, and you know where that got us. So we should not hold Barack Obama to any angelic standards. It doesn't work like that. This man will have to do anything to be elected. Now, let me conclude by saying, if Barack Obama was a black dog, I would vote for him. We need anybody but another black person. America has been in existence for over 200 years. It's been run by white people. Give a black man a chance. I don't care. You know, people play a mind game. They say, you're voting for him because he's black. Yeah, I'm voting for him because he's black. I want you are blacker than black. Okay, as long as he doesn't kill a black man or vote or do anything to another black person, I will vote for him. Because why? This is an equal opportunity country. If my daughter wanted to be president, and by the way, I will vote for Hillary Clinton, too, to be the first black woman, because black men have run this country for 200 years. What more do we want? Give other people a chance, man. Come on. Let them make the same mistakes that George Bush made, that everybody else made. Give them another chance to make the same mistake they made. As long as they don't go around killing people around the world, we will vote for them, okay?
And I listen, brother, let's look at this. You have a Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, who is black.
She doesn't have the power.
Who is black.
She's a woman. She doesn't have the power.
And you see, it's not a question of a black face in a high place. You know that Barack Obama just recently stated that he would find it necessary to use private contractors like Blackwater. That's not only in Iraq, but you know where Blackwater was deployed? You want to talk about not killing people? They were part of the martial law in New Orleans and the Gulf. 70,000 such units and troops in imposing martial law on the black working class victims of New Orleans and the Gulf. That's you have to make a distinction between the ethnic affiliation of a Barack Obama and whose service he functions politically. If your concerns are for the emancipation of oppressed African Americans and you're from Liberia, brother. What about the murder of Africa that is unfolding with genocide after genocide that U.S. imperialism imposes?
Come on, Rob, that genocide been committed by white people. Come on.
This is committed by imperialists and they're black and white utilized in that. There are sellouts continuously.
You know what I mean?
The point man for the murder of Patrice Lumumba, yes, was Carlucci. Do you know who the protege of Frank Carlucci was? Colin Powell. The role of black capitalist figures in the administration of one regime after the other in the oppression of people across the world, black or not, is continuous. You have right now in South Africa 52 to 56% unemployment. All of the land remains in the hands of the white settlers. You know, you can integrate the beaches in Durban, brother, but if Harry Oppenheimer continues to own the mines, what does it matter to have a black face in a high place enjoying the perks while presiding over the apparatus of the white imperialist exploitation of Africa?
Okay, let's move on. You're on the air.
How you doing?
How are you, brother?
Welcome to Taking Aim and WBAI.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I guess I want to hit a couple of topics that you've addressed. Hopefully I won't forget one of them on my head. Firstly, you raised the point early on that many of the people that are backing Obama are from the previous Clinton administration. I'm wondering what that says about Hillary and the fact that she's doesn't receive, I guess, wholehearted support from the people that used to back her husband. Second, I would ask the other issue of Israel. You made a comment previously, and I would ask the question of how much responsibility of the whole situation over there the Palestinians and the other groups hold for their ongoing attacks on the, you know, Israelis. And then you also raised the question of religion in South Carolina. I guess I would ask, how about the other areas of the world where you have countries that have religion-based government, such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and things like that?
Okay, I'll address the third and the first, and I'll leave Ralph to the second. You had three questions there. We are for democracy throughout the world. We don't believe in any indecent exceptionalism for the state of Israel. We don't believe in exceptionalism for Saudi Arabia or any other country. We are for democracy throughout the world. We are for socialism. We are for the radicalization and the democratization, and this means in all aspects of society, and that inevitably means socialist revolution. So your first question about Hillary Clinton, she has Democratic Party Clinton supporters, Clinton administration supporters, such as Madeleine Albright, who was the Secretary of State and is now the chairperson of the National Democratic Institute, and she is Hillary's foreign policy advisor. Samuel Berger, who was President Clinton's national security advisor. Lieutenant General Daniel William Christman, a West Point superintendent, and also a Democratic Party supporter. General Wesley Clark, who was President Clinton's commander-in-chief of forces in Kosovo and is now a Democratic Party fundraiser. President Clinton's Navy Secretary, John Dalton. The list goes on and on. You have, in other words, the entire structure of the Clinton administration, the apparatus, including Martin Indyk supporting Hillary Clinton. He was Clinton's ambassador to Israel, and he is director of the primary Zionist functioning state intellectual apparatus in the United States, for the Brookings Institute's Sabin Center for Middle East Policy. So you have, the list goes on and on. What we have here is among the Clinton administration functionaries splitting between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. In other words, it's the same old, same old. Ralph?
Well,
for the second question.
Yes, but I'd like to amplify this. It shouldn't surprise you to find that the same people who support the Republican administrations, whether it's Reagan or Bush Sr. or Bush current, and the same people who were involved in the Carter administration or in the Reagan administration or in the Clinton administration are supporting both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. In other words, what you always have here is the structure of power through the military and intelligence apparatus and its bureaucracy that implements policies for whatever nominal candidate these two parties produce. The only reason there's a populist rhetoric for the moment is because there's a disaffection in the population, and they need to canalize and to channel and to co-opt, diffuse, and contain the disaffection of the mass of the population, particularly when they are going to preside over a deepening and extended crisis, an economic crisis. Bear in mind that both...
A crisis for the people, not a crisis for corporations.
Well, there is a crisis for the system. It's a system that's incapable of meeting the needs of the population. The crisis of capital is that the economy is disintegrating. The crisis of capitalism is the collapse of the dollar. The crisis of capitalism is this vast indebtedness of the system. Trillions and trillions of $72 trillion of accumulated debt. The crisis of capitalism is dependence on permanent war and permanent military operations. The population is sick of it, wants no more of it, repudiates it, and is abundantly anxious about the destruction of the entire social service infrastructure that had been fought for over 100 years. That's a deepening crisis of the system, and the population has to be suppressed.
As is reflected in the Washington Post study the other day that said 1 in 100 people in the United States are incarcerated, and the figure among black youth is astronomical. Ralph?
Well, so to come to the fundamental issue here, it's a system, a structure of power. You know, we've often talked about how 1% control more than 95% of the wealth than the rest of us combined. And these two parties are financed by the same people. There's a great deal that's been made about the $50 million raised by Barack Obama, $35 million raised by Hillary Clinton in 1 month, as if this is the result of the nickels and dimes of poor people. Yeah, they get the contributions from people in small amounts, but the vast sums of money are provided by the huge banks, financiers, and corporations. The biggest backers of both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, bigger than the Republicans, are the arms manufacturers, Lockheed and Boeing and General Dynamics. They are, so you have to see the structure of power that behind which these people posture. And they're not exactly concealing what they have in mind. I mean, Barack Obama is making it very clear. We're bogged down in Iraq. We have to translate that into some kind of stable victory for the United States. So we're free to go after Pakistan. We're free to go after Saudi Arabia. We are free to contain Iran. And we're free to go after, quote, the terrorists in any country in which they have a shelter. What do you think that represents, brothers and sisters? They can't pull that off without a massive repression within our society. It doesn't matter whether it's Bush light or Bush heavy or Clinton or Obama. That's the capitalist agenda.
And Michael's giving us the cue that this is time for station identification.
Yo, this is G-Love on WBAI, New York, New York. Mm-hmm.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We're continuing our program today, Barack Obama, the Democratic Party, and the corporate state, false hope and short change. This is part two of the call-in series. And the number to call at WBAI is 212-209-2900. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, yes, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for bringing to light all this thing about Barack Obama. I'm sort of making a debate to myself, and I'm sure a lot of people out there are trying to, you know, not vote for the oligarchy that we have going here. What do you think about voting for Ralph Nader? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, brother. Look, I think...
Good question.
I think the critical point that emphasize for our listeners is that we need to be able to build a political movement independent of the two capitalist parties. That means a party that's based on working people, on the oppressed, on African Americans, on Latino poor, on the working class at large, on the population that has no stake in perpetuating this imperial system. Ralph Nader and the Green Party have one flaw that is, to me and to Maya, a fatal flaw, namely that they present themselves as a pressure group on the Democratic Party. They conceive of it, their role as pushing it to the left, by which they mean a New Deal. Of course, the New Deal itself was a stabilization undertaking for capitalism, very short-lived, very minimalist in what it undertook, and the second term of the New Deal saw a depression that dwarfed that of 1929. There was 17% unemployment in 1938. So what'd they do? They put people to work for the merchants of death, and capitalism has been addicted to arms ever since. So when Ralph Nader says, as he did in his last campaign, if you are living in a state where the race is close between the Republicans and the Democrats, vote for the Democrat. If the Republicans are going to win anyway, then vote for me. So that we show that there is a sympathy and support out there for a liberal course, for a reform course, for a left course, quote, left unquote. And this lesser evilism notion of pressuring the Democrats to do the right thing is why we are not enthusiastic about Ralph Nader, because... I think I can get away with this. I was at a conference, Maya and I were in Michigan, for the Labor Party. And, I won't do it, Maya. You can't blow out of one side of your mouth and out of the other at the same time. Is what Elaine Bernard of the New Democratic Party, who now teaching at Harvard, labor rights.
Something like that, Ralph. But anyway, in other words, you have to pursue a forward course. There is no intermediate course. It's not a question of lesser evils. It's not a question of raising issues in order to reform the Democratic Party. At the time of the first Clinton election, the New York Times had done a study that showed that people were disgusted, thoroughly disgusted with both parties and were ready for something new. And it was at that time that Tony Mazzocchi, formerly of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, the person who's actually responsible for the development of the OSHA, the Occupational Health and Safety laws in this country, and he had a dream of forming a labor party. But he didn't conceive of it, and he brought people around him who didn't conceive of it as a true political party that would launch candidates and would function as a party. It was conceived as a pressure group. And consequently, people who had real expectations, working people and union locals throughout the country, who rallied to the idea of having their own party under the slogan, "The bosses have two parties, we need one of our own," they rallied, and they were very sadly disappointed, because the more they pushed to actually run candidates and have expression of their own and to get out there and fight the good fight, it was undermined. It was taken from them. But this is something that we need to do, and we can't give up. This is what is needed. We need our own political expression. Ralph?
Yes, well, I would. You see, the issue is this. You have in our country literally 150 to 200 million people, working people, who hunger for something else. I mean, 84%, according to the New York Times, of the population rejects both the Republican and Democratic parties. Roughly about 12% actually support one or the other party while holding their nose in a given election. Right now, they were talking about a big turnout in Ohio and Texas in the primary. You know what they're talking about? 52% of the registered voters, brothers and sisters. It's a joke. 52% when they're so proud of this of young people having been enthused about Barack Obama and being brought out to vote because they have hopes for change. 52% of the registered voters, you're talking about roughly at best 27-28% of the eligible electorate, and you cut that between the two parties. What are we dealing with here? We've said this before. There is a need that people feel for a political expression that will represent our interests. And here you have a circumstance in which the population is facing total economic disaster. People are one paycheck away from losing their homes. They're barely more than that from being homeless for vast millions of people in the United States today. And we have a society in which trillions upon trillions of dollars are devoted towards the not just capitalist profit, but to the merchants of death. It's obsolete stuff off before it's off the assembly line. It's $10 trillion in 40 years official. They lose $7 trillion. We know that we could eliminate all poverty, wipe out all slums in the United States, build affordable housing free, have health care, have it is a birthright. Right, like the air we breathe. We have the productive capacity and wherewithal to transform our society. That's hope, that's change. But it's concrete, and it means overthrowing capitalism. It means that the mass of our people who want these things, who can hunger and can sense the possibility, lack a political expression. It isn't Barack Obama. It can't be the Democratic Party. Barack Obama is funded by the folks who brought you the war in Iraq. And we'll bring you the next one as well. Let's go to the next question.
Michael? Hello?
Hello.
Is there
yes,
a caller online, please?
I'm online.
Yes.
Okay, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have a couple things. One is I just want to congratulate you on really being the only program that brings up the kind of information that can help people understand what's going on. That being said, I would like to say that, and you know, it's one thing to say political expression and people need to be able to do that, but I think what people don't know and what it's taken me so long to learn is people don't understand the Bilderbergs, they don't understand the CFR, they don't understand the Trilateral Commission, they don't understand how the Federal Reserve works, they don't really understand what they're up against, that the media is completely controlled. And so I don't think people can find political expression just because they're tired of either party. People need to be educated and understand exactly what they're up against. And it is extremely dire. And to say we know our country's in huge economic crisis, but no one really understands why. And I'm hoping that you will help with your program to really not – you know, I mean, you do great things, but I feel like a lot of it is too hard for people to grasp. People need to understand the ABCs of exactly what they're up against so they don't read the newspaper and watch TV and think that they're not being manipulated.
Well, let me address these points, which I appreciate your posing these issues. I have to tell you that neither the Bilderbergs nor the Council on Foreign Relations nor the Trilateral Commission are anything more than the standard think tanks of the rulers. They are not where power resides. And interestingly enough, with respect to the Council on Foreign Relations and many of the people who are going to be making policy for Clinton or for McCain or for Barack Obama come out. They are certainly in the Council on Foreign Relations where they prepare their position papers. But you know who else was in the Council on Foreign Relations? Edward Said, Richard Falk, Richard Barnett, some of the liberal intelligence. Nation magazine is intimately related to these think tank. Yes. Katharina van der Hoeve and her father was involved in some of the Central Intelligence Agency fronts and so on. Because these are people who are the transmission belt for ruling class ideology in a certain sense, because they convey the idea that there is an alternative within the system within which changes can occur. Modest changes, though they may be. And so that having been said, the point about where power lies is that it's these think tanks don't explain it. Bilderberg is just a hotel in Holland where finance ministers and bankers meet and discuss common issues on an annual basis. But where they meet and the name they give to the hotel does not reflect how their power is organized. It's organized around the means of production, about ownership of corporations and banks. One point about the Federal Reserve, because the right wing brings up all the time these issues of the Federal Reserve, and Bilderberger, frankly, tends to become a kind of code name for Masons and for
Jewish bankers.
Well, Jewish bankers, royal blood, and that kind of thing. This is mystification. Frankly speaking, the Federal Reserve in 1913 didn't do anything more than codify what had been structured in the United States in 1787, namely that private banks and finance capital determine economic policy and control the levers of power and within government. All that the Federal Reserve is an administrative apparatus for the banks to make policy on behalf of the ruling class, which is imposed upon the population at large. But that's not new. It's not the Federal Reserve as an institution per se. It's banking capital. It's finance capital, it's corporate capital that's in the hands of an owning ruling class. They average 14 corporate directorships per person and so on. There's a rich sociology about this. William Dumhoff, who Rules America, C. Wright Mills, The Power Elite, the writings of Charles Beard, the historian, Frederick Lundberg, 60 Families, the rich and the super rich. It's not as if this literature is unavailable to us. The delineation of how a ruling class is structured, how corporate capitalism is set up, is not mystical. It's very concrete sociological data. And the question of our people, to come to the point, and just very briefly, right now, for example, in the Gulf, Mississippi Gulf and New Orleans, the Black Reconstruction Party has been organized by Black activists and working class activists. Cynthia McKinney has been very active in that. And it challenges the two capitalist parties. It calls for precisely the kinds of things that are necessary, namely the control over the economic life and political life of the Gulf by the people who were targeted for victimization there. That means that the housing has to be subsidized by state that is an answer to the people whose interest is supposed to exist. That's not only applicable to New Orleans. As we proceed, because I can assure you of one thing, whoever wins this election, assuming they even allow an election to be held, because they're facing such a major economic crisis, and they're, the papers are very clear about what they're preparing a major war. A major war involving Gaza, a major war involving Lebanon, a major war involving Syria, because capitalism can't subsist without it. And they want to get their tit out of a ringer in Iraq, where the resistance has presented them with a tremendous problem. They want to try to stabilize that in order to free themselves to continue elsewhere with the same agenda. Any functionary who's in office in next year is going to be doing the same, and they're going to stage and carry out operations of repression at home as the population is increasingly angered. There's no shortcut to this, but our people see what's happening to them, and they want change that means an end to all of this, and there will be an emergence increasingly around trade union movements, rank-and-file movements, the crisis of the many, organizing themselves politically, coalescing for a challenge to corporate capitalism by name. So there is a day approaching when the Democrats and the Republicans who have used up, they've already used up 90% of their what can I call it, their ability to lie to us. It's vanishingly slim. How much latitude is remaining to the ruling class? That's where we're at. That's why we organize. That's why we promote the evidence on taking aim, and that's why we're building a movement nationally, all of us together, to challenge this rotten system and to overthrow it. Nothing short of that. Let's be very clear about that. We need to overthrow corporate capitalism. We need to remove this oligarchy from its dictatorship over our lives. The dictatorship of money and the dictatorship of repression, the perpetual incarceration of the mass of our young people, that's the agenda of capital. It is not going to get better. It's going to get worse.
Okay, next question. The number to call, I'm going to remind people first, is 212-209-2900. You're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Taking Aim.
All right. It's a pleasure to be here. I must concur with your earlier caller, Michael, about some of the issues that he raised and also the gentleman that's speaking. But just for the sake of terms and understanding, you speak about a lot about democracy. But if we break democracy down and reflect back to the organic constitution, there is no mention of democracy in the constitution. It speaks of a republic in which each individual person has a sovereign capacity to exercise their own rights and thoughts as long as it doesn't interfere with another human being. Now here, at some time, this so-called democracy was created, but it was created for the wealthy landowners to control property. It's very much like an oligarchy where you have a few that are in eminent control with both financial resources and other resources to take advantage of the less fortunate. You know, because if you research the Constitution, there is no mention of democracy there. And the more enlightened ones like to say, well, this is a democratic republic. There's no such animal. There's never been. And you speak about dollars. Well, in 1933, the United States of America Corporation was incorporated. The Constitution was suspended. And therefore, we have a whole system of operation that's being operated under corporate policy. Because even yourself, you spoke of the policies. Corporations make policies. Governments make laws. So we aren't operating under constitutional law.
Let us address the point you're making. I would certainly agree with you that the 18th century revolution in the United States was a property-based bourgeois revolution. It was nonetheless a revolution against the autocracy and the divine right to rule on the part of monarchy. It was a revolution that was designed to create representative institutions, which was a tremendous challenge to the autocratic rule of kings by divine right. And in order to do that, property-owning class, as you rightly described them in the United States, required and relied upon the poor, the artisans, those who had been persecuted and who settled in the United States. We leave out with the fate of the Native Americans for the moment in regard to this settler population. The fact of the matter is that the first 10 amendments to the American Constitution, the Bill of Rights, was the result of a rebellion, an armed rebellion, the Whiskey Rebellion. And the sentiment of the poor farmers and the artisans and slaves, let it be clear, Crispus Attucks, who was one of the first seminal figures in the American Revolution as a former slave, the point about this is that the property-owning class set up these what you call checks and balances to keep decision-making in the hands of the property owners. And there's been a continuous tension between the aspirations of the population and this formal bourgeois rule. But the fact that the ruling class empties democracy of content and maintains monopoly over the power is not to say that we don't have a desire to overthrow this system and to restore control of economic and political life to the population at large. Of course,
or that we don't have democratic aspirations.
But see, if you give the people the political latitude to exercise their right by Republican representative, because as you stated, the democracy was developed by the property owners. Therefore, if you look at
democracy. It's a challenge to autocratic rule was waged by the property owners to arrogate to themselves the right to set up institutions where they could make decisions about their interests between them. And to confine that to themselves, to the decision-making largely to be confined to their hands, using the population as a kind of support apparatus, but always excluding them from any decisive control over the state of affairs. There's nothing democratic about that. We call it a bourgeois democratic revolution.
As opposed to the democracy that evolved out of the Paris Commune and was a model for the Soviets, the early Soviets, which was where your delegates have immediate recall. In other words, if they don't satisfy the needs of the people who are putting them into office as they're expressing their desires, then they can be recalled immediately. And that is a very different form of democracy. It's direct, you might say it's direct rule by the people. Okay, on to the next call. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, my name is Carmelo, and I want to thank you for this wonderful program. I listen to you every Tuesday.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Carmelo. Glad you're on.
I just have a question. My question, I guess, is basically, what choice do we have when it comes down to an independent presidential candidate that is not controlled by the Zionist organization in this country? I mean, we have McCain who wants to. I'm a former Vietnam, I'm a Vietnam veteran, former Marine.
Yes.
And I'm disappointed with McCain with his pro-war rhetoric.
Right.
You got Hillary who voted for the war and also voted for the resolution labeling the Iranian army as a terrorist.
So that's right. And Barack Obama voted for every war appropriation for the war in Iraq. You know, excluding none. Go ahead,
I'm disappointed with Obama. I was hoping that he would be more independent and maybe get us out of this quagmire from Iraq and also be a fair broker in the Middle East between the Israeli and Palestinians. But we don't seem to have that. So. To the American public, who would you vote for? I mean, here we are. You know, who's the lesser
of evil? Well, if Cynthia McKinney runs on the Black Reconstruction Party, I would support her because she's challenging the two parties. She runs as a Green, I would not, because the Greens represent nothing like a challenge to the two-party system. But I appreciate what you say, and of course, the mass of our youngsters who are used as cannon fodder and sent off to in a poverty draft or as in a poverty army or to fight with these wars on behalf of vast oil corporations and the military, the U.S. imperialism, and their wars against oppressed people whose labor is being stolen, whose natural resources are being stolen, and our youngsters are being made to serve as cannon fodder and to oppress those people, and they become radicalized out of their experience, out of their suffering, out of the horrors that they have to endure, out of the neglect to which is imposed upon them, and over the systemic disease which every veteran knows about, the result of the neurological defects arising from depleted uranium and imposed anthrax and the toxic weapons that are the what they use for these imperial wars. This vast sector of our population will find a political expression. It is emerging continuously. But when there isn't one, we don't have to pick and choose amongst our oppressors. That doesn't get us anywhere. We have to point out what is the nature of the political reality at a given moment and challenge it. That's, I think, the right response, brother. We don't have to pick and choose amongst Republicans and Democrats. We have to look for a way to explain to our people that these are fakers and that the problems won't be resolved by them. We have to do it ourselves.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today has been a call-in show, and we were glad to have each and every one of you contact us. The name of the program, Barack Obama, the Democratic Party, and the Corporate State, False Hope and Short Change, Part 2, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com, as well as on the WBAI archive at www.wbai.org. Please contact us by email at takingaim@patbell.net. And we'll be with you next week with a regular program. The committee.